Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
This episode contains references to suicide and language that might not be suitable for everyone. Please use discretion. How did the two of you meet?
On the internet, OkCupid. He was under Laser Eyes. I was under Hog Book.
Maria Bamford is a comedian. Stephen Colbert says she's his favorite comedian on Earth. And Judd Apatow has called her the funniest woman in the world. But performing isn't that comfortable for her, and she's had to figure out ways to keep doing the thing that she loves. We wanted to talk to her about that and all kinds of things, but we started with the story of how she met her husband, the artist Scott Marvel Cassidy.
He was one of the only people who responded to Hog Book. We had coffee. He was less than 5 miles from where I lived. It turns out his roommate I'd gone on two dates with. And, well, the wonderful thing about Scott Marvel Cassidy, amongst the thousands of wonderful things about him, is that we had both had a very similar experience of, like, not being able to make long-term relationships functional. And so I think both of us looked at each other in the eyeballs and said, let's do this. We went to therapy 3 months in. We have continued to get tons of help from wherever we can get it. Because I don't know where are you? What is it like where you live? You're in North Carolina, right?
Yeah.
Well, Los Angeles has this thing.
It's a little, Los Angeles is a little different than North Carolina.
It's a different, well, in terms of romance sometimes and relationships in general, friendships too. Like they'll say, I mean, if someone's toxic, I just let them go out of my life. Goodbye. And as I've gotten older, in 2004, I declared it the No Friend Left Behind Act. That means I don't care what you do. I'm staying with you. Like, we're going to work it out. Because everybody's toxic. I mean, everybody's a nightmare. So that kind of thing, like with romantic relationships, you know, I'd always kind of go, oh, there's a red flag. And then, but then when describing myself to anybody, I am obviously a red flag factory, only manufacturing giant red flags. So, yeah, Scott, when I told him, and he knew that I had experience with mental health stuff. And he said, listen, if you go into the psych ward, I'll come in and shave your beard, which was one of the most romantic things I've ever heard. And vice versa. You know, he had experiences in childhood that gave him some PTSD. And he has some suicide attempts and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, this is it. Like, I'm not going to.
I'm the woman for you.
I'm the woman for you. What if we're each other's bests?
Maria Bamford and Scott Marvel Cassidy got married in 2015.
I'm so grateful to have him as my partner and my beloved in my life. And we also have really had to change and fight to make things work, you know, to know how to de-escalate conflict. Like, I had to learn how to do that. My modus operandi is to fall into tears and then run away, preferably miles away. He shuts down, sometimes says something he regrets. And, you know, it's like two dysfunctional ways that are not going to work over the long term. We've done the Gottmans. Have you ever done the Gottmans? They're a relationship guru. Also we got into a 12-step program for two different ones, one Recovering Couples Anonymous, chapter, and then one called Chapter 9, both free, both weird. And we've done all the things, all the things. Yeah, because I was like, I'm always grateful when somebody goes, because I've just never had an experience where in a relationship where something's been like, and then it was just meant to be. It's just like, I just felt like, yeah, this is right. Like, I've just never had that. I've always felt terrified at a certain point during any sort of romantic relationship. And friendships. Friendships, I've felt terrified, so.
Isn't it funny when someone says, you know, it just seems like you're putting a lot of work into it.
Yeah.
And it seems like you're working to make this work. I don't know.
And fair enough. You know, if that's somebody's experience, they go, oh, yeah, you know, that's not me. You know, I like things. If it's easy, then it's meant to be. Well, then that's great. If that's worked out for you. I was like 40 years in, and I haven't had anything ever been easy. So, like, let's just relax into it and just go, okay. Because I never want to do anything. Work does not come easily to me. Like, I am not somebody who likes to get up in the morning. You know, so the idea that I'm going to suddenly find one human being that makes me want to, yeah, embrace life seems to be a lot.
A lot of Maria Bamford's comedy directly addresses her experiences with depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and bipolar 2 disorder. A diagnosis, she's joked, has become so popular, it's the new gladiator sandal. Do you find that you're being open about your own personal struggles, your mental health struggles, has made you more connected to some of your fans?
Yeah, well, yeah, that it's more meaningful for sure. Like, I've always appreciated when there are artists of any type who make me feel more welcome and you reflect experiences I've had. I get it more out of reading mental health memoirs like Kay Redfield Jamison or Mario Hornbacher or The Center Cannot Hold, Ellen Sachs. Just knowing that that person exists, it just makes me feel very comforted. So I hope that I can be a comfort to anybody. I'm really grateful for that. It makes me feel useful and connected. So it's very selfish reason to be talking about these things as well, because I go, if people laugh, that means they have some experience with it. And so I'm not by myself.
I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love. Maria Bamford performs live a lot. It was hard to schedule time to sit down and talk because she's almost constantly on the road, performing here and internationally. If you can't afford a ticket, she's got her email address in her Twitter bio. And if you email her, she'll try to put you on the guest list so you can come to her show anyway. And if you follow Maria Bamford on Twitter, you'll also notice that from time to time, going back years, she'll post asking if anyone is available to sit down with her, one-on-one, while she rehearses her material.
It is surprising how many people, especially when I'm in Los Angeles in the LA area, who are available. I've also done it over Zoom, which is also good. And then I will also pay dear friends to listen to my act too, who are professionals and so therefore need to get paid. But otherwise, if I do my act for you, I will usually either buy you a snack, you know, lunch, whatever, sky's the limit on the menu, or send you a t-shirt. And anyways, I haven't been killed yet.
And they know what you look like.
Right.
So it's you don't have to hold up a sign saying Marie. I mean, they're the one, because you don't know what they look like.
Yeah. It's always been very positive, sometimes a little odd for reasons of me being not the greatest socializer. But yeah, and I do it as much as I need to, which is usually, I did a spot last night, it was about 10 minutes, and I wish I had run it by somebody, but I didn't.
What happened? And,
oh, no, just feeling wobbly. It's a feeling of wobbliness.
I haven't, I'm no performer, but we take this little show on the road sometimes and do this show, you know, live. And my biggest fear, I can't even talk about it. My biggest fear is that I would almost not want to have an intermission, because my biggest fear would be that after intermission, I'd walk back on stage and 2/3 of the crowd would have left.
Oh, yes, I have walked the room many times where that can be a point of honor, where you've really weeded the wheat from the chaff. And, you know, who are really the fans?
That's right.
And let them go home. I've seen that happen at plays where, you know, a beautifully produced play that, you know, has probably won a Pulitzer Prize or something. And then because there's traffic or people are just tired, they just go, oh, I think we've seen enough of that Shakespeare. We kind of know how it's going to end. And then, yeah, people leave. So I totally relate with that. It's okay. Sometimes I think that's when heckling starts in comedy, is when people feel trapped, as if it's a hostage situation and they were forced to stay there.
A hostage situation in a theater experience for me, or in any type of, is when the Q&A starts. That's when I feel as an audience member that it is a bit of a hostage situation, because if you stand up to leave, you're not only insulting the performers, but maybe you're insulting the person who's asked the question, that their question wasn't good enough. And so there's two people that you're now disappointing. But you just don't know when it's going to stop, too. So Q&A is a hard thing for me.
I've got to tell you, now, have you heard of Beyoncé? I went to go see her in a stadium environment. While she was singing her very heart out, now at the time she was pregnant, so fully pregnant, beautiful sequin dress, wailing, and when I say wailing, I mean professionally, operatically singing, I believe, Make Love to Me. That was one of the phrases of the song. People were getting up and going to the bathroom or, you know, getting a snack. What? People will walk out on anything. So just, it's okay. You know, people will walk out on miracles, on historic moments, I'm sure.
That must be someone who has a pretty good life. You know, if you're just saying, you know what, Beyonce, I've got it. I need to get some more popcorn. You probably have a pretty rich life if you can just, you've seen a lot if you can just get up at that moment.
Or acknowledge that any moment in life, once you've been there for a while, can become tiresome. Yeah. Your children's eyeballs. Do you ever stop looking into them? You ever go, he's still here? I think over time, anything can be boring.
Are you asking these strangers that show up to hear the first rehearsal? Are you asking them for feedback? Or are you
no,
just watching?
No.
that's not, I mean, do you give them that? I mean, do you say, thank you so much for showing up. I'm going to do my act. Please don't tell me how you feel about it.
No. They could say whatever they wish, of course, but it is me. And they've said they were a fan. So I assume they want to hear the material. And those also are usually people who are like me, which are introverted, overly polite to the point of dishonesty people.
Is it? I mean, it kind of feels like because you've got this direct, rapt attention of one person when you're doing when you're doing this rehearsal, is it more intimidating than doing it in front of a crowd where faces kind of blend together and the spotlight maybe blinds you a bit?
Yeah, I like the face-to-face. Now, the most intimidating ones are when someone keeps doing chores while they were on a Zoom. Like if they're doing stuff around the house and the camera's moving, so they're busy and I see their cat, and like that, I feel a little bit anxious about. Like I go, oh shit, I'm not, you know, I need to work on that because if laundry is, you know, a much bigger laugh than I am. Yeah, it's always surprising to see the person is. What's really fun is you see their internet persona, and sometimes it can seem very different. Usually it'll be a lot quieter, like the people have a more aggressive Twitter handle. And then when you see them in person, they're like, yes, you know, I'm fuckchop 86, but I have collectibles in the background.
We'll be right back.
Support for This Is Love comes from Quince. Cultivating a wardrobe where you would actually wear everything you own is a bit harder than it seems. I found that I prefer clothes that are well-cut, well-made, and functional. Quince is a brand that offers a variety of timeless, well-made luxury essentials that could fit in almost anyone's wardrobe. From gold jewelry and organic cotton sweaters to real cashmere and washable silk, Quince has plenty of high-quality items all sold at a reasonable price. Quince's items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Recently, I got the linen quilt set for my mother. The quilt is incredibly comfortable and easy to wash. Hers is light gray, but there are a number of good colors to choose from. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/thisislove for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/thisislove to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/thisislove.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
Let's just start, if we can, with you introducing yourself.
I'm Jim Sherwin. I live in Portland, Oregon.
How would you describe Maria Bamford's comedy?
Oh, gosh. Absurd. Manic.
And you replied to one of her requests on Twitter for someone to rehearse with.
I did, yeah.
Were you nervous?
Terrified, of course.
I mean, what made you think, I think I could be the right guy for this?
I have followed her work, and so I'm familiar with her, and I'm a huge fan, of course. I was terrified of being an audience of one, that I felt like I would have to perform as well for her.
Because she'd just be staring directly in your eyes.
Which is exactly what happened. And that was hard.
Did you meet in Zoom?
We did, yeah.
Did she prepare you at all for what was about to happen?
No. I opened my screen and then I saw that she was in a hotel room. So I knew that she must have been on tour, which makes sense because I think I saw on her Twitter, her ex, that she had been posting if I'm in Dallas, I'm in Charlotte. So I guess it reminded me like, oh yeah, she's touring. And then she sort of asked me where I was from and what I did. I don't think there was a lot of banter. I think she just sort of launched into the set.
I think I would have felt a remarkable amount of pressure to just be constantly smiling.
Oh, of course. My cheeks hurt, I think, by the end. I mean, but also I was delighted. But I also didn't feel pressure to laugh at one. The first part of her set was familiar. I recognized it. And she had changed a bunch of things and added some jokes here and there, which I found hilarious. And I guffawed many times authentically. And then she got into some new material and she announced it. She said, okay, now I'm going to transition to some new material. And I think at that point, I remember being engaged and feeling I was responsible for giving her feedback, like good or bad. She's testing out new material. I want to let her know how it resonates with me. And so I wasn't constantly laughing. I was constantly smiling. I was making eye contact the entire time as much as one can through a computer screen. And yeah, it felt really raw of her to do that.
How did it end?
I think she'd said at the top of the hour, I'm going to take 45 minutes of your time. And then she looked at the clock and she said, oh, I've taken 50 minutes of your time. And I said, that's fine. That's great. This has been such a joy. Thanks so much. And I remember like wanting to say something, knowing like break a leg tonight, just to say like, hey, I bet you're going on tonight. And even though you're a seasoned, very successful comedian, you probably could still use the encouragement of a stranger like me, a fan. But I didn't say it. I just said, this was so great. Thanks so much for including me. And then we hung up.
Have you seen her in person before?
I haven't, no. I think one of the reasons the idea of the show, the Zoom with Maria was so appealing is because I have some anxieties around going to big venues with a lot of people. And so this felt like it was perfectly designed for me, somebody who maybe has a little bit of social anxiety, but who still really enjoys live comedy.
A private show.
Yeah, a private show.
How did you first get this idea to do this one-on-one?
Sloth. I just thought, I just want to meet one person, have a nice time, be in my zip code so I don't have to go anywhere. And it also gets me, I mean, if I'm out of town, it gets me out of my hotel room just to see a different part of the city. A sloth plus longing for connection with anybody. Those are the two things, sloth and loneliness.
Does it also help you right before you're going to go on for the performance with stage fright? You know, think,
yes.
I've already run it with someone. They thought it was okay. I'm going to be okay.
Yes, and even if they don't think it's okay, that's great practice too. Most times people won't say, like, I'm worried for you. But sometimes they do. Like, I've had people say after I've done, and I've done this hour for the past 3 years. So sometimes I'll do this hour to somebody's little face and they'll say, so have you just started working on that? So is it pretty... I mean, it seems like it's coming together, maybe. And I'm like, how dare you? This is a slick 60 minutes.
Are there any other things that you do to help with stage fright besides these one-on-one?
I think setting, I like to talk with the comics beforehand, like setting goals, like saying, okay, I want to talk to three people in the audience tonight, or I want to enunciate, or I want to try this new tag or this new joke to sort of have something to celebrate after the show with the other comics that we've all done something different in our acts. And that bookending process of I'll call somebody beforehand, I'll call somebody after saying how the shows went so it doesn't feel so lonely. I mean, it could be for anything in life where I feel terrified and then suddenly I, you know, realize, oh, it's a safe place and I'm all right.
Maria Bamford grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, and she often impersonates her mother and father in her act.
My parents sent me to a therapist, or the one therapist there was in town in Duluth, which was, I think I was around 9 or 10. And, you know, it wasn't perfect, but it was an effort where I felt cared for as a child. I didn't sleep at night because I had this OCD, intrusive thoughts OCD, where I was afraid that I was going to harm others. And so I would try to stay up all night to make sure that I wasn't going to kill my family. And it turns out that's just a very common type of OCD. But I did not learn that until I was 35. But in the meantime, when I was 10, got to go to a therapist. And I don't think there wasn't a lot of understanding of what was happening. But I think the love was there, which I feel very grateful and lucky to have experienced.
So your parents, they weren't intimidated by thoughts you were having. They took it in stride, you know, trying to help, of course, but they didn't panic.
Yeah, no, they were, I think they were just confused by it and hoped that I would get it together. I did manage to keep things high and tight in terms of I was able to finish high school. I did get into college. I think I developed an eating disorder in order to manage some of my mood swings and stuff, and then went to a 12-step group when I was about, I think, 19, and got help for that, which, you know, 12-step groups are not perfect, and I love them. I love them so much. But there's culty, pseudo-spiritual, paternalistic language. Aren't always welcoming in terms of sexual orientation or race. Like, there are certain issues that come up, I don't think in a conscious way, but I think subconsciously aren't always dealt with in those groups. But it was free, I must tell you. It was free. And my parents were very down with, my dad went to ACA, which Adult Children of Alcoholics, and brought me to one of those meetings. So they were always into self-help, that kind of thing.
She's written about her experiences with 12-step groups in a memoir called Sure, I'll Join Your Cult. What did your parents think of your comedy?
So I think they were just delighted for me that anything was going well. The fact that I may be paid for something, and I think I got I did a one person show and got some reviews for doing stand up that were positive, and I think they were like, oh my God, thank God you're doing something. I think that's what they were. They could have cared less, just as long as I was earning some money and able to take care of myself.
Her mother died from cancer in 2020. And her father died from COVID in March of 2023.
I love them so much. And so I think I still, in my current hour, do impersonations of my mom. And, you know, I felt kind of self-conscious, like, oh, maybe that's creepy or sad, you know, about me as a person that I still doing impersonations of my mom, but it does bring me a lot of comfort to think, even in an impersonation of her, that I can kind of still have her around. And I'm not someone who, I don't have that belief always in the afterlife or a god or something like that. Like, I know my mom didn't want to die. My dad did not want to die. And I don't think it's changed how I feel. You know, like, I can't remember. My mom gave me something about a reading about death, and it was something about how death is nothing at all. Act as if I've just walked in the other room and laugh at the jokes we've always laughed at, you know. I think I would like to do that, to keep my mom alive. My dream would be to play my mom in a TV show or something, just where I could just be her all the time. Because she was a good lady. And this way I could put in my own edits, completely controlling my mother like a puppet.
Would you ever be your mother to your mother? You know, just switch into her character?
Yes.
If she was annoying you or something, would you just switch into her and give it right back?
Not, hopefully not in a mean way, but definitely. Well, and my mom would sometimes try to pitch me jokes. Like, I could tell when she was looking for the comedic angle of something. You know, like, well, honey, I went to the mall, Miller Hill Mall, and I went to the Liz Claiborne. Mom, you're selling it too hard. Get to the story. Where's the punch? My mom was such a great person, and I think that, if anything, it's made there less urgency for me in the world to realize, like, how, I mean, these are things other people have realized long before I, you know, that how ephemeral things are. And yeah, to just now is all I have. And so, you know, I didn't want my parents to die in order to learn that. So there's been no educational value in my parents' death. Let me be clear on that. I hate those stories where it's like, and then the real gift my parents died, they had full lives, and so it wasn't totally tragic. It was tragic to me, and that's all. Yeah.
I mean, do you feel some way, you know, that you're keeping your mother and your father will be kept close to you and with you by sharing them with your audience, by keeping them in your jokes?
Yeah, for sure. And just to, that I can still have their parenting, and I don't have children. And I think that whole thing of my parents' legacy, like, I do love the idea of keeping their memories alive, because I just think they were amazing people. But I don't know how to do that beyond doing comedy, which I'm sure there's some other way to do it. I'm sure it involves engraving something on a building. I'll get back to you.
We'll be right back.
May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
I was reading that at one point when you were really struggling with your mental health, you were in the hospital, and you were asking your doctors if you'd be well enough to do comedy again. Were you ever worried that at some point you wouldn't be able to do it again?
Yeah, no, I mean, for about a year, and I think like any illness, it can be severe enough that can really take you out, you know, and I was unable to get any comfort that it was going to get better or that it would be okay or that I still was able to do my job. Like, that was really not available to me, and I was doing everything that I could. You know, I went to an outpatient treatment program. I had full coverage through my union, the Screen Actors Guild. I had all the things, all the many, many, many things. And I think that is the really scary thing about any health issue is like, oh, is this going to come back? Am I changed by this for the rest of my life in a way that is depressing to me? Like, my meds that keep me really stable also make me very sleepy and have my hands tremor a lot. And when I was still feeling wobbly, those two factors were a real bummer to me. Like, I was like, oh my God. And if people say, oh, why don't you try a different medication? Well, you can go fuck off. And and thank you for that idea. Yeah, when you found a medication that works in any way, it's so rare and delightful. But yeah, I think that's the scary thing. Is the not knowing. And I definitely didn't know. And I came back to doing stand-up and did not feel at all comfortable or ready or qualified or any of the things. And, you know, for me, it worked out. But I also don't want to speak for others to go, oh, yeah, it's always easy. So, or it always works out, because that's just some people have, you know, much more severe experiences. And so, and there needs to be more support and that everyone has health insurance, et cetera.
You found a way for comedy to work for you in using it and being able to take part of it.
Yeah, and it's a very privileged position. I mean, comedians, the arts, it's already okay to be banana pants. Like, my job at most is 4 hours a night. You know, I go to a club, do two sets, and I'm also applauded the whole time. Like, so many times it's asked of entertainers or famous people, you know, like, oh, how do you handle mental illness? And it's like, I'm doing fine. How are the people who have no time, have no money, have too many responsibilities? Those are the people. How are they doing it? Like, I just don't know.
Does the work that you do, the privileged work, as you say, that you get to do by being a comedian, does it make you happy even when you get to do those one-on-one rehearsals with a stranger who reached out? I mean, does just the act of telling the joke make you happy?
Yes.
One or 300 people.
Yes. Oh, I love it. Yes, I do. I love, and actually I do sometimes prefer a one-on-one show just because it's really connecting with somebody and I can ask them questions about themselves and I get to hear what's going on in their lives or hear their act. Sometimes it's other comedians. And so it's that, I think, is really my favorite. I do like one-on-one. But you can't make a living doing one-on-one
at the Dunkin' Donuts.
Or can you?
Years ago, Maria Bamford bought a park bench. and put it in front of her house in Los Angeles. She said it's like a bird feeder for humans.
I read in a community study library done in Denmark, as they all are, and they said if you give people a place to sit down, they will come. And that is true. If you sit them, they will come.
Do you still have that?
Yes. There are less people sitting on it. We used to be more central to the city. And then, oh my gosh, the bench, it was just, you never knew what was going to be on the bench. It could be a baby and her mother, or it could be somebody meeting for a first kiss. It could be, you just never know. A lot of times they're smoking, or there was needles sometimes are on the bench, intravenous drug use are on the bench.
It's the full plethora of life.
Yes.
You're seeing it all.
Well, and now we live in Altadena, which is sort of a smaller mountain area. So there is not, well, there's some action. Sometimes we've had hot Cheetos near the bench because I think there's some high school students that sometimes hang out next door. We saw one condom wrapper once, and we have a little library. So, you know, occasionally we'll get some stoppers by. I've got to tell you, if you've ever thought about making yourself a little library, sometimes you get Dan Brown, and you've got... Except that's, you know, some people won't take out their own trash. And
did you read Da Vinci Code?
No. And he's a craftsman. Of course he is. But I have meticulously created a mental health memoir nook. And then, you know, just to be shat upon by... Bill O'Reilly's and Robin Cook's and how dare you.
Maria Bamford and Scott Marvel Cassidy have written a graphic novel about how they met. It's called Hawk Book and Laser Eyes, and it comes out this summer. This Is Love is created by Lauren Spohr and me. Nadia Wilson is our senior producer. Katie Bishop is our supervising producer. Our producers are Susanna Robertson, Jackie Sajiko, Lily Clark, Lena Sillison, Megan Knane, and Gabrielle Burbet. Our show is mixed and engineered by Veronica Simonetti. This episode was mixed by Emma Munger. Learn more about the show on our website, thisislovepodcast.com. And sign up for our newsletter at thisislovepodcast.com/newsletter. You can listen to everything we make without the ads by becoming a member. Being a member of Criminal Plus is a really great way to support our work, and you get bonus episodes and virtual events. To learn more, go to thisiscriminal.com/plus. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at This Is Love Show. This Is Love is part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Discover more great shows at podcast.voxmedia.com. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.